Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity today. We have good, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, and all of it is brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. Stop spending a fortune on gimmicky shave tech you don't need. Make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. Get your first month for only $5 with free shipping by going to dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Great product. More on them in just a moment. David, it's been a long time since the last day of the U.S. Supreme Court session in late June was one that left a lot of conservatives smiling. We're going to devote two good martinis to that today. But can you remember a day at the end of the session that has made conservatives this happy?
I really can't. I feel like I'm drunk on delicious martinis.
We're just going to keep serving them up. So let's start with good martini number one. This is courtesy of Fox News, and this deals with the court's handling of the travel ban. In a victory for the Trump administration, the Supreme Court on Monday lifted key components of an injunction against President Trump's proposed ban on travel from six majority Muslim nations, reinstating much of the policy and promising to hear full arguments as early as this fall. The court's decision means the justices will now wade into the biggest legal controversy of the Trump administration, the president's order temporarily restricting travel, which even Trump has termed a travel ban. The court made clear that a limited version of the policy can be enforced for now. Quote, an American individual or entity that has a bona fide relationship with a particular person seeking to enter the country as a refugee can legitimately claim concrete hardship if that person is excluded. As to these individuals and entities, we will not disturb the injunction. But when it comes to refugees who lack any connection to the United States for the reasons we have set out, the balance tips in favor of the government's compelling need to provide for the nation's security, unquote. So, David, you have just finished writing about the legal significance of this for National Review Online. What is the significance of this?
Yeah, this is a huge victory for the Trump administration. I mean, basically what's happened here is that the court made very short work of the lower court's overreach. Because let's be clear what the lower courts did here. They essentially took a plaintiff, like say a university or a family here in the U.S. And let's say that university wanted to bring a few students who'd been already admitted to the school to the school, or a family wanted to bring a mother-in-law. What the courts below did is they said, well, because you want to bring your mother-in-law, we're going to ban enforcement. We're going to prevent enforcement of the travel ban for every single person in the six countries and for every single refugee that it's applicable to, which is an incredibly broad ruling. And what the Supreme Court did is it came in and it said, wait a minute, unless you have a direct connection to the United States, the government's national security interest is going to trump any interest that that person in that foreign country might have in coming to the U.S. And so the court reinstated the ban for all of those people, which is the vast, vast majority of the people who live in the six countries or are affected by the refugee ban. And then it also, you know, what was also notable about the case, there's a couple things. One, it didn't talk about Trump's campaign statements. It just didn't analyze that. It analyzed this in terms of the law and national security and a balance of the equities, traditional legal analysis. And the other thing is, of the nine justices, six were signed onto the per curiam opinion, which overturned most of the lower court's injunctions. And the only three dissenters were people who wanted the entirety of the travel ban reinstated right now. So it looks like the lower courts were too radical, even for Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That's how radical they were.
Wow. That doesn't happen too often. They really
know
the lower courts have really found themselves outside of the judicial mainstream, if we want to use that term. So, David, what else has to be decided now later in the next term?
Yeah, what has to be decided is whether or not it's going to be interesting because the clock is now ticking. So this is going to be argued in the October term. But the pauses, the days that these are 90-day pauses and 60-day pause, these short pauses will have expired in large part by that time. And so arguably there won't be much left for the court to deal with in October. So I think the really interesting thing is going to be if the pauses expire, if the Trump administration finishes its internal reviews, what is going to be left to really litigate here. And it might be the case that the Trump administration imposes the pauses, creates its new, more permanent regulations, and then tells the Supreme Court, "Now, you know what? We don't even really need this case heard anymore because we have our permanent policy in place." And it may be smart for the court to do that because they've got a big victory now at the Supreme Court. The lower courts have been rebuked. And so there's a good argument here that the Trump administration should take its victory, implement its permanent policies, and then fight about those at a later date. But we'll see what happens.
David, how did the 9 Supreme Court justices not see what the lower court judges saw, that line in the Constitution that says this is not constitutional if Trump wants it?
Well, you know, that's a great question. But I tend to think that there's that old saying that where you stand depends on where you sit. And one of the things about the Supreme Court judges, unlike a lower court judge knows that whatever they say is going to be subject to further review, and they can get out more over their skis. But a Supreme Court judge knows that they're the final say. And the limitation on executive power in over national security in the lower court's rulings was pretty dramatic. And I could easily imagine a Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Sonia Sotomayor saying, do we want to permanently adjust the constitutional balance of power all because Donald Trump is president of the United States? And they might balk at that. And in fact, it looks like they did balk at that.
Well, that decision on the travel ban came just minutes after the Supreme Court also ruled on a key religious liberty case that a lot of people were watching closely, especially once Neil Gorsuch got on the court. This is also Fox News. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday ruled in favor of a Missouri church that sued the state after being denied taxpayer funds for a playground project because of a provision that prohibits state funding for religious entities. The ruling was 7-2. The case, one of the most closely watched of the term, pitted two provisions of the First Amendment against one another, freedom of religion and separation of church and state. The dispute involved Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri, and the state of Missouri. In 2012, the state launched an initiative to encourage schools to use recycled tires to produce softer playground surfaces. Trinity, which runs a preschool, was denied a state grant to participate in the program, and lawyers for Trinity argued the state discriminated against the school based on religion. Let's go to the decision itself now, which was authored by Chief Justice John Roberts. The state, in this case, expressly requires Trinity Lutheran to renounce its religious character in order to participate in an otherwise generally available public benefit program for which it is fully qualified. Our cases make clear that such a condition imposes a penalty on the free exercise of religion that must be subjected to the most rigorous scrutiny. He also says the state has pursued its preferred policy to the point of expressly denying a qualified religious entity a public benefit solely because of its religious character. Under our precedents, that goes too far. The department's policy violates the free exercise clause. And then towards the end, Roberts writes, the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has not subjected anyone to chains or torture on account of religion, and the result of the state's policy is nothing so dramatic as the denial of political office. The consequence is, in all likelihood here, a few extra scraped knees. But the exclusion of Trinity Lutheran from a public benefit for which it is otherwise qualified, solely because it is a church, is odious to our Constitution all the same and cannot stand. David, how big is this one?
This is a big one. And I'll tell you why. One of the primary ways in which religious liberty is restricted in the U.S. is this notion that where the government is, religion cannot also exist. And as the government grows larger and larger and larger, the sphere of truly private behavior begins to shrink. And so essentially what the state of Missouri was saying is if we create a program and we use tax dollars for it and we use public funding for it, anyone can participate in this as long as it's not a religious entity. And again, that's just growing the public sector and restricting the spaces where religious individuals can operate freely and fully. And the court saw through this and said, wait a minute, no. There's nothing that establishes a religion about putting rubberized flooring on a playground at a church. That's not creating a state religion. I mean, this is absurd. And so what this essentially is saying is it's one more brick in a wall of precedent that is saying that if you create a government program and the purpose of that government program is neither to advance nor inhibit religion, Well, then you can't exclude religious entities from participation in that program. And it's a common sense ruling, and it's one that I think is going to have some important precedential value going forward. It's not a revolutionary ruling. It's just another good step towards protecting religious liberty. It's a very important step. It's a good step. It's not a revolutionary step. It would have been revolutionary had the court gone the other way. Had the court gone the other way, that would have opened the door for all kinds of government programs intruding more and more into people's lives, deliberately excluding religious individuals. And it would have been a profoundly negative consequence. So sometimes the best news is the expected news. In the best news that we avoided the truly big news, which would have been a bad ruling in this case.
In addition, other news on religious liberty, the court will hear in the fall session at some point a case regarding the very controversial debate over vendors and same-sex weddings, whether or not you are constitutionally mandated to provide such a service. So what are we seeing from the court on religious liberty here in these two cases?
Well, we don't know yet. You know, all that we know now on that's the Masterpiece Bake Shop case. Mm-hmm. All we know is that four justices wanted to hear it. So I'm not going to call that good news on religious liberty unless there's a good decision. It's entirely possible that, you know, these issues are where Justice Kennedy has often sided against religious liberty. And I think of a case, Christian Legal Society versus Martinez, where Justice Kennedy sided with the liberal justices and held that a Christian group could be required by college to be open to non-Christian leadership. So these are the kind of hot button issues where we don't know where Justice Kennedy's going to come out. So I'll have to hold out. I'm going to take that martini and I'm just going to set it aside for about a year and I'll taste it then and see if it's good or not.
You might want to put that one in the fridge or maybe even the freezer. But hey, the U.S. Supreme Court deciding things based on what the Constitution says, I would call that a smart choice. And you know what else is a smart choice, David? Dollar Shave Club. It is, in fact, the smarter choice. You will get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. It's a no-brainer choice. You no longer have to schlep to the store to buy a cheap disposable razor that gives you a cheap shave. At the same time, you don't have to spend a fortune on razors with gimmicky shaving tech that you just don't need. And as folks know from previous times we've highlighted the Dollar Shave Club, I am a very happy customer of them. You get great shaves at a great price. With your first package, you get the good quality professional handle plus four different shave cartridges. They're supposed to last you a week. If you are lazy like me and you let them go for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, they're still going to give you a great shave, but you don't have to, because then each month you get a new box with your four cartridges, and that is just fantastic. So along with those in your first package, you'll also get the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter, and once you apply that, the blade glides so gently and gives you such a smooth shave. Plus, the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter is transparent for a more precise shave. It helps to prevent ingrown hairs and fights razor bumps. Now, David, I know you're a guy who wears a beard a lot of the time, but you still know a good shave and you know a good deal.
That's right. And now listeners to Three Martini Lunch can make the smarter choice by joining Dollar Shave Club. For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5 with free shipping. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month. That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, a full cassette, and four cartridges and a tube of their shave butter. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees and no commitments. You can cancel anytime you like.
You can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/martini. dollarshaveclub.com/martini. This deal is available for you right now. Once again, dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Well, David, it's 2017, so we know that we couldn't go a full episode of the Three Martini Lunch without some crazy news. So let's talk about that. It is June 26th, which means we have, I guess, 4 days left in what the left has somehow convinced somebody to declare Pride Month. So blissfully, that'll be over in a few days. But it's not without some controversy within the gay community. This story's gotten quite a bit of attention. Yet again, we turn to Fox News for this one. LGBT Pride festivities in Chicago took an ugly turn over the weekend when three women were ejected from a march because their rainbow flags bore a Jewish Star of David. The Chicago Windy Times, the city's LGBT paper, reported that the women were told they could not take part in the city's march because their flags made people feel unsafe. It's funny because this march is separate from Chicago's main Pride Parade and is described by organizers as being more inclusive and more social justice oriented than the main event. But one of the women told to leave the march, Lori Grauer, said her so-called Jewish pride flag, which is basically the rainbow flag with Star of David on it, from my congregation, this is her now talking, which celebrates my gay and Jewish identity, which I have done for over a decade marching in this march with the same flag. They were telling me to leave because my flag was a trigger to people that they found offensive. She went on, prior to this, I had never been harassed or asked to leave, and I'd always carried the flag with me. March organizers issued a statement on Twitter Sunday afternoon, which said that the women were told to leave the march, quote, after they repeatedly expressed support for Zionism. The statement went on to say that the organizers are explicitly not anti-Semitic. We are anti-Zionist and support the liberation of Palestine and oppressed people everywhere. David, I guess the bottom line here is that this movement, which is supposedly the paragon of tolerance, is the exact opposite of it.
Well, yeah, it's just more exclusion in the name of inclusion. But what's so funny about this is if your focus is on gay rights, the most gay-friendly nation in the entire Middle East is Israel.
Right.
And the people who Israel is consistently fighting for its existence against are the very people who often execute gays in the most brutal fashion possible. So is this really a gay rights parade, or is this just another festival of social justice warriors under, you know, one particular identity politics banner? And but, you know, that's what identity politics is becoming. It's a movement of progressives who cloak their progressivism and their radicalism behind their identity. And things like this kind of expose them for what they are.
So, David, when you watch stuff like this, does it make you bang your head against the table for how crazy things are getting? Or do you pop the popcorn and watch the left eat itself?
On that one, I tend to pop the popcorn because that's the kind of thing that's so extreme that even an awful lot of people on the left who are thoughtful and fair-minded just shake their head at. So that kind of extremism, I think, is self-defeating.
Wow. David, a big day. Enjoy those first two martinis anyway, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. We appreciate you being here 4 days this week.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
David French of National Review, in for Jim Garrity, who is on vacation today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And a quick reminder to visit our friends at Dollar Shave Club, dollarshaveclub.com/martini. Remember, $15 in value for only $5. And join us again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.